You're about to hear my conversation with Roop Dahta, the lead manager of our global quantitative equity boutique. We talk all about how he approaches money, how he's incorporating machine learning into his process, and his recent world low volatility fund launch. I hope you enjoy. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Information relating to investment approaches or individual investments should not be construed as advice or endorsement. Listeners should seek professional advice for their situation. Welcome to The Invested, a podcast from McKinsey Investments. My name is Matthew Schnur, and I'm delighted to be here with Roop Dahta. Roop leads our global quantitative equity team. Roop, welcome to the podcast.
Matt, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I thought we'd start today with a bit of a broad question, Roop, and maybe just open it up with, how do you manage money?
So just a little bit of background on myself. This is my 31st year doing what I call quantitative equity, which is literally fundamental equities, but levering technology a lot. So we are fundamental equity investors. That's what I've always been, except I've levered technology a lot over my life, including now. And so that's what we call fundamental quant managers. So that's how I manage money. Our forte or strength is stock picking. That's how I've delivered alpha all through my career. The style we always focus on is to be as agnostic to any particular style as possible. I call that core, which to me, it means that we should be able to generally navigate different environments, whether it's value, whether it's growth, whether it's quality, reasonably well. That's the goal. And that's why I say my leaning has always been core, which keeps it simple for me and for the investor. I'm not as much swayed by market cycles. And hopefully my process is that all-rounded and core that we can navigate those three environments, which is sort of where the market is either one of those three rather well. The second thing we do is we run, thanks to McKinsey, we do have a very nimble 10-people team in Boston. That's where all my investment career has been based out of. Boston is, in my view, the mecca of quant investing, and that's why I've been always based here. And not only are we very nimble, the benefits of that is we are a very cohesive team. Everyone does everything in this team, which allows us to be very nimble in terms of adding new metrics to our process when we, you know, decide how to invest in stocks. At the same time, we're also nimble in how we trade. So whenever a new stock gets up to our topmost ranking, we'll buy it the very next day, whereas many of our competition rebalances the portfolio once a week, once a quarter, once a month. So in summary, my style has always been very core, and at the same time, be nimble enough to not let AUM and other things bog me down.
That's great, Roop. And I hope we'll get into a little bit more detail on those different components. Just a general question as well. When you're developing these models, and you said quite elegantly that it's quant investing, but with fundamental-like characteristics, where do you start your process? Do you start it sort of at a region level? Do you just look at stocks? How do you think about that?
Yeah, we have a reasonably decent views on global versus regional versus country mandates. Matt, the question you're asking is, how do we rank stocks? To me, global ranking means I'm ranking against global peers. Regional means against regional peers, and country means against country peers.
Right.
So to me, when it comes to the developed markets, we actually use a blend of global and regional view. Let me just bring it to you more through perhaps a US example. You know, let me explain Walmart or maybe another large cap company. Let's go with Nvidia, for example, you know, the talk of last year and this year.
Sure.
I would say whenever we look at stock, we have our own views on how it ranks versus its regional peers. In both these cases, it'll be versus the US peers. US is its own country region for us. We break down the world into four regions: Japan, Europe, US, and the rest all in one, which is Australia, Canada, and Asia ex Japan. And so therefore, when we're looking at a Walmart or Nvidia, we look at their ranking against their peers, their own sector peers in the US and also globally. And we combine these two thinking into a final view on that stock. And the way we put them two together is if you're a larger global player, and both the names I mentioned tend to be global players, Walmart and Nvidia, we will rely more on the global ranking because in our view, global stocks are followed mostly by global investors.
Right.
Whereas on the other hand, if we have a small cap US Canadian name, we will largely look at a regional ranking because those stocks are largely invested by either US or Canadian investors. So in summary, it's a combination of a global and regional view when we look at developed market stocks, global equity stocks throughout the world.
And how does the benchmark inform that decision on regional or country as far as overweights or underweights? Like what kind of guidelines do you have within that?
I would say the benchmark plays more of a role in terms of more than the benchmark. I think whether it's EM or DM, emerging markets or developed markets plays off a role in our view. I would say when it comes to emerging markets, we have entirely a regional process because what we find there is a regional view of stocks is everything that you need to do in emerging markets so far. So even when you're looking at a Samsung, we look at it more from an Asia ex-China standpoint. Whereas as soon as you go to developed markets, which is the global equity fund or other funds that we manage, it's a combination of regional and global view.
And I know that we've recently launched a World Low Vol fund that you're looking after. Now, while it's new to a sort of a mutual fund, an 81-102 mutual fund available to be purchased widely in Canada, Low Vol is something that you actually have one of the largest amounts of assets, I think globally, in Low Vol mandates. Can you tell me a little bit about how you make your process work for Low Vol?
Absolutely. I mean, thank you for asking. The first thing I would say is we have been running emerging markets, international US money for, you know, 6, 5, 4 year periods now. And once you have all of that in place, you start your global portfolios. So actually the predecessor to the new fund that we manage, that we launched, the World Low Volatility, we have been running money in that strategy now since July of 2020, approaching a 4 year period. That's a separately managed account we run for a large investor. And this is just bringing that to the mutual fund format, to the retail format. So that's the low vol version of the global equity fund, which some of you may be familiar with. You know, we have a global equity fund, which my team took over managing from November of 2020. Now, we have now the low vol version of that available in a fund from a month or two back called the World Low Vol. So I would say these are two sister strategies. The benchmarks are different for the global equity fund. It is a standard MSCI World Index, the most commonly followed index. But for the low vol fund, we run it against low vol benchmarks. And here it is the MSCI World Minimum Volatility Index, which is a low vol part of it. So what's the difference? You know, we look at, if you look at it sectorally or country-wise, I think at a high level, low vol means all else being the same, you're investing in more or less less volatile stocks, period. That's what makes it a low vol fund versus the global equity fund, which is invest in all kinds of stocks in the global markets. So there's two things that's the main difference in the, so that's the main focus of the low vol index or our strategy too, and then delivering excess returns on top of that, just like we try to deliver excess return on top of the MSCI World Index for the global equity fund. Now, that brings me to, so what are the differences perhaps regionally and sectorally? I would say the main thing I would say sectorally, as you can imagine, for low vol indices, the sectors that get higher weighting are your more stable sectors like consumer staples, healthcare. Those stocks, if you look at the volatility, they are usually a lot lower than, say, technology.
Right.
So therefore, if you go from a global equity fund to the World Low Vol New Fund, basically your weighting in staples and healthcare around the world will go up significantly. And your weighting in technology and consumer discretionary, which are more volatile sectors, will go down. So sectorally, there's a bigger difference between our offering of more than 3.5 years and the new offering. Country-wise, actually, the difference is more limited, but I looked at the country lineups, and I would say the countries where actually the low vol index has higher weight, Japan's weight goes up, Switzerland's weight goes up, you know, because Switzerland has a lot of healthcare companies, a lot of pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, et cetera. And the weights of a couple of the markets like US and UK go down. It's simple to explain US. US is still the dominant weight at 63-64%, but it's 70% in the global equity fund.
Right.
The reduction is because US has a lot of technology names. And sure. If you reduce technology weighting, US's weight will go down.
Makes a lot of sense, Arup. So some of the characteristics are a little bit different. That seems to make intuitive sense, I'll call it, just given the fact that you're going to low vol. From your process, though, Arup, is it the same models, the same insights, the same research that you've put together on your quantitative career over the past 30 years that you're applying to low vol versus the global fund?
Absolutely. I would say our view on a stock like, let's say, Lululemon or any name remains the same, whether it is for a global equity fund or whether it is for the new world low volatility fund. That is, our ranking for that name remains the same. Hmm. Obviously, the amount of, as I just said, discretionary or amount of technology names I'll have in each varies because of the low vol versus lack of low vol emphasis. So the ranking of a name remains the same, but how many of those similar names will make it through into one portfolio versus the other varies. One more thing we do is, since if people are investing in a low vol fund, the way I think of it is you're looking at global stocks throughout the world with a low vol bent to it. So one additional constraint we use, or additional thing we look at, is we want to make sure that our fund has equal to or less volatility than the low vol index. So the low vol index versus standard index usually have 60% of the vol. So you have a much lower volatility, even though both are in equities. And we make sure that we, as we are trying to beat the low vol index, don't go above that. So usually our volatility is slightly below that, even of the low vol index, which is sizably below that of the global standard indices.
Got it. So the additional constraint is just one of volatility, which makes perfect sense, because in order to outperform an index as low vol, to take on more volatility would, of course, be counter to the thesis of the strategy. So,
and Matt, yes. If I may come back, you had asked me a question earlier, so I'll just speak to that. Yes, we are one of the largest players in the low vol side, you know, for not offered yet in mutual fund offerings, but we have, I can just tell you that we run emerging markets, Canadian, US, and world low vol strategies. In Canadian dollars, they add up to about $4 billion, which make us, in my view, and my team manages about $10 billion or $11 billion currently in Canadian dollars. And at the $4 billion mark for low vol, we are one of the largest players in low vol strategies throughout the world.
That's great. Certainly, you have the dedication and team focused on those strategies to support the substantial business there. I guess one of the things that I think about when I think about quantitative investing is technology, and that it's all technology enhanced and driven. And clearly, over the last, ever since OpenAI came with ChatGPT, it's been all the rage on large language models and AI in general. I'm curious, is there anything new that you're doing on machine learning or AI in general and how you incorporate it in your strategy?
Yeah, I would say I've always had a very big core philosophy, whereas all the metrics we look at in terms of growth, value, quality, in picking a stock, what's the growth, how does it rank on growth, quality, and value, have evolved over time. And they'll continue to evolve as we sit today. And so towards that, I would say that we have added many new ways to look at growth, value, and quality in the last 6.5 years we've been at McKinsey. In terms of actually machine learning, or what I call natural language processing, which are sort of, you know, to me, the latest and greatest things of the last 5 to 10 years in quant land, we do have metrics there that employ these that are in a live process. What that means is we do employ these metrics in picking stocks. We have been doing that for 4 to 5 years already. And I would say one new one, if I may add, is something we added about a year back, is where we are actually predicting the fundamentals of a company, in our view, better than what sell-side analysts are predicting. Wow. And that's using a machine learning technique. And in that, if our machine learning-based model which is a nonlinear approach, as you may know. And this model, the reason we got comfortable is we have been using, it was based on a back test built over more than 20, 25 years of data, nothing short term. And what it does is it picks up on nuances that sell side analysts have and adjusts for it in a nonlinear way. And we come up with our fundamental predictions of, let's say, earnings of a company. And if that is very different from where the sell side analyst is, consensus is, we bet on it. And that's one of the newer growth metrics we have added to our process. And we have added it all throughout the world, whether it's emerging markets, whether it's the global equity fund, or whether it is the world low volatility fund.
That's great, Arup. Great example. So maybe one last question, Arup. At the beginning of the conversation, you talked about the importance of being nimble, the importance of trading within your portfolio. When I think about trading, I think that there's a cost to it as well as an opportunity to get in. So how do you account for both the upside and the cost of trading your portfolios?
I mean, as I mentioned, we do daily ranking of our stocks and trade based on that. And that's, in our view, a key advantage of us, for us, against almost any manager in the world, whether it's quant or fundamental. Because one of the benefits of quant is we can rank stocks every day. We actually rank stocks twice a day, once in the morning for our North American trades and once in the afternoon for Asia, Europe from Eastern Standard Time. So to me, implementation is always going to be a cost. Transaction cost is always a cost. And to me, I believe this is an area where we are very focused on. When we started running money at Boston, we wanted to have a trader embedded within our team in the Boston office, which we have had from day one. He's still with us. And therefore, because we believe trading and implementation is as bigger part of our process as stock picking and portfolio construction. So with his help and my team's help, we closely monitor transaction costs. We actually, before every new trade we put in, the model or the process that we build takes into account round trip transaction costs predicted before we decide to buy a name. And therefore, it's already factored in when we're getting into a name. And then as we execute a trade, we look at not only just the commissions or stamp duties we are paying, we also look at the more important number, the market impact. How much are we moving a stock compared to yesterday's close in buying it today or selling it today? And we have found that all through my career, including the last 6.5 years at McKinsey, that our actual transaction costs or market impact cost runs reasonably below our model's own prediction. In other words, what I'm saying is trading is never, in my view, a value add. Bad trading could be a value negative.
Right.
In our case, we make sure, and this has been a key part of my process, that we make sure that the execution is top class and that we are executing to the best of our ability. And I believe so far we have, as we have grown the assets from almost nothing to $10 to $11 billion today as we sit.
Well, Arup, I want to thank you for spending the time sitting down with me, walking through both how you manage money as well as what you do for the New World Low Vol Fund. So Arup, thanks very much, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you again, Matt.
The content of this podcast, including facts, views, opinions, and recommendations, is not to be used or construed as investment advice and is not an offer or an invitation to buy or sell any security. The content of this podcast should not be relied upon for any purposes, and Mackenzie Financial Corporation is not responsible for any reliance upon it. This podcast includes forward-looking information that reflects our current expectations or forecasts of future events. Forward-looking information is subject to risks, uncertainties, and assumptions that could cause actual results to differ materially from those expressed herein. Our views are subject to change based on market conditions. Commissions, trailing commissions, management fees, and expenses may be associated with mutual fund investments. Please read the fund facts and prospectus before investing. The indicated rates of returns are historical annual compounded total returns, including changes to unit values and reinvestment of all dividends or distributions, and does not take into account sales, redemptions, distribution, or optional charges or income taxes payable by any security holder that would have reduced returns.